I'm not going to comment on that. I'll get fined for the rest of my life if I get commented on that.
Fourth and five, the national championship on the line right here. He's going for the corner. He's got it. Vince Young scores.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to another College Chaps podcast. Well, I openly admit that we seem to have spent quite a bit of time this year on the Pac-12, and rightly so, as there's just so much going on. In fact, it's a bit Wild West, and there's nowhere wilder right now than in Boulder, Colorado here. Deion Sanders' revolution is well and truly underway, so we thought we would spend an episode talking about those crazy Buffs. But first, as you know, with the College Chaps, I'm George, and I'm joined by Ollie and Hollywood Hank this week, as AC joins us live from the City of Angels. Happy Memorial Day weekend to all our US friends and to you both, gents. How are you?
I feel like I should hand the floor to Alex, because he's, you know, he's the celebrity of the podcast now, and this is so rare for him to actually deign us with his presence.
All I'm going to say is that Ollie says that he's a college football reporter, right, for a living. That's his job. But only one of us was on the ground at USC when Mike Bonn resigned. You know, that's all I'm going to say.
It's true. It's absolutely true.
All I'm going to say.
Good to be back. Good to be chatting. We have to ask him if he got the scoop, and I think the answer to that is no. So, yeah, boots on the ground, but no bloody good if you don't get the scoop, Alex.
Yes, well, I can't talk too much about how I found out about the news. It's all
conflicted. I think you're conflicted. Yeah. So maybe it's time to move on to Colorado. And But it's good to have you. Good to have you back. Even though you're not back, you are a special guest. You're several thousand miles away, which is a bit of a weird experience.
Yeah, I'm glad you lads have stayed up into the night to the point where I could actually join on. It is crazy. It is fun doing the podcast from out here stateside. You know, it's so much easier to kind of blanket yourself in the news of the college football world than it is compared to at home, you know, with ESPN and everything else going on all the fucking time. There's always something being talked about in terms of college football. So, you know, it's good to be back, especially in this kind of quiet period for college football as well. It's nice to be able to pick up on some of the stories that are jumping around. And Colorado are definitely a team that are interesting to me this year. You know, don't know whether I agree or disagree with what they've done, but I know I'll be watching.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. So let's delve into it. And I guess just as a prelude to that, right, I was reading the story about Marcus Rosenmeijer said today, right? And before we get into the Colorado situation, here's another college athlete that's been driving a car at silly speeds. And I guess, you know, young boys in cars, you're always going to have them. But I kind of threw this in at the start because I was curious on your thoughts that, you know, young lads will be young lads. It's inherent in their DNA. I wonder, does this situation gets worse with NIL, where money comes a lot easier to them? You know, at a school like UGA, there'll be no shortage of sponsors and boosters wanting them to drive a Mercedes-Benz or whatever it might be. I don't know, maybe I'm kind of prejudging, but it does feel as if there has the potential for a lot more of this to go on. And you give a fast car to a young superstar, I think there's some inevitability about it, but maybe I'm just showing my age.
Well, to me, I think you need to look at and ask questions of the University of Georgia at this point, because it's not like this is widespread across the college football landscape, at least being reported. There's four Georgia athletes this calendar year that have been involved in reckless and dangerous driving related charges. You know, it's time for the university itself to step in and look after these kids. You know, there's obviously someone there that's giving them cars, or, you know, they're giving them the money to go out and own these vehicles. When they're obviously not mature enough to do so. And you know, these colleges have a duty of care to their athletes and their kids, and you know, the kids have got to take some responsibility for it as well, obviously. But at the same time, yeah, one institution that's failing its athletes right now, and that's the University of Georgia. And you know, if they don't step in and put some measures in place to correct it, then it's time the NCAA did, because they would do in any other walk of life if one university in the country was acting dangerously or not putting the correct safeguards in place to protect its athletes. And to me, it looks like that's what Georgia's doing right now, is or not doing right now, because it's their kids that keep getting into these situations.
Ollie, are we shooting at Georgia because they're top of the tree? Or has Alex got a point, or other schools got similar issues that are just not as highly reported as what's going on at Georgia?
Yeah, no, I think Alex is right. It's, you know, like he said, there is, you know, four reported cases this year alone. I obviously, as a back to back reigning national champions, there is a greater spotlight on the program, but it doesn't matter where you play college football. If you are in trouble with the law, you will find out in this day and age of social media reporting. It doesn't matter what program you play for. So I don't think it is happening widespread, certainly not to this degree across the nation. It's interesting, Georgia themselves, both at the time of the incident, which sadly cost Devin Willock his life, they said then that they've worked with student athletes and had people involved with student athletes discussing these sort of things. And Kirby Smart said it again in the press release yesterday or today, that, you know, they have had people on campus talking to students about, you know, the dangers of driving in the manner that has obviously occurred over the last few months with various different student athletes. You know, there is clearly an issue at the school, and you know, like Alex says, there's some responsibility at different levels to be taken by different people, whether it's coaches, whether it's higher up in the university, whether it's the kids themselves, whether it's the NCAA and how they legislate or regulate what's happening with things like NIL, because like you guys say, ordinarily an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid doesn't have the hands on a Ferrari, Lamborghini or a Mercedes. And through name, image and likeness, which is something I think we all agree benefits athletes in the way they should be benefited from their contributions to the university through playing football for the university and for the programs around college football. But it does put the players in situations that historically, previously, they wouldn't be able to be in. You know, I think sports car dealerships or car dealerships on the whole are one of the biggest components of name, image and likeness deals. You look around college football and it's, you know, ex-player, Christian Mahogany at Boston College has a nil deal dealership that gets him a BMW, for example. And, you know, I think pretty much across every college football program, you're going to find one or two players, or, you know, multiple players that have got some sort of nil deal with a local car dealership. And it is just putting those sort of vehicles in the hands of kids who ordinarily and historically wouldn't have the level of access to that sort of machinery. And, you know, it's something that does need probably some sort of regulation, some sort of legislation, to make sure there's proper education and to prevent incidents like this happening, because it is only a matter of time until you have another sad incident like we saw earlier in the year.
Before we move on, because we don't want to spend too much time talking about this, although it does give us a nice segue into the next section, Alex I think, raised a really valid point. I can't say for certain, but I would have thought that Athens is one of the smaller college towns in the nation. It is a very compact town. Coaches tend to know everything that's going on. I mean, this is not like a USC campus. What can the coaches do? Because presumably, morally, I think that is a different issue, right? But there's a fine line between recruiting a player to come to campus with the enticements that are coming, and let's not beat about the bush, because those are there. I mean, Jack Saint's been at Georgia for a while now, so he's not the latest wave of recruits, right? But I'm keen to hear, Alex, your thoughts on where's the line to be crossed. Now, I know morally where the line is, right? But in terms of the, you know, the recruiting, enticing, et cetera, et cetera, I mean, for Kirby Smart to go in and take the keys off players, I suggest is not going to happen. But there has to be some action taken by the school, right?
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on that side of things, a little bit about the way you recruit and what your philosophy is. So for me, I recruit the person, not the athlete. You know, there's an element of recruiting the athlete as well, because they have to have the ability to come in and play at the level required. Otherwise, they're not going to have a good time at the university. But the person is far more important. I would not recruit someone who's great, but is the wrong personality, the wrong personal fit for our system. And I think some of these top college coaches are going to have to start doing the same, because if you're giving these kids that access, it's irresponsible to recruit these kids, give them everything, give them the world when they're not used to having the world, and not give them the guidance that they need to experience it. I'm not saying that these kids don't deserve the world when they have this amount of talent. They absolutely do. But you have to help them manage it through. You have that duty of care is the word I use, or the phrase I use a lot around student athletes, because they're young, they're immature, they don't have the life experience that they need. So yeah, it's on the Georgia coaches, it's on the Georgia staff to adapt the way they work to this new world that's out there now with name, image, and likeness. You know, you have to change the way and adjust the way you work with these kids to make sure that you actually have kids just still around. You know, it could very easily have gone the other way with these kind of events, and it could be, you know, two or three of your athletes that then lose their lives, and that's all it takes for major change to happen. But it should happen before we get to that point.
Yeah, and it feels like, you know, there's no question that Georgia hasn't had the red flags before. Let's move on to our intended topic. But there is a little bit of a link, which is why we threw this in. Colorado, talk about splash. Anywhere Deion Sanders goes, there is news and splash and color and, you know, kind of excitement and all of the stuff that goes with them. So without preempting what you're going to say, Ollie, what does Deion Sanders bring to Colorado? Because I think most people appreciate we're talking about this some months after he joined Colorado, but most people would not have thought that was his intended landing spot. Most people thought he was going to go back to Florida State. So why Colorado, and what does he bring?
Well, I mean, the fact that we're a podcast based in the UK, having an entire episode devoted to one, give or take the fact we've just spent 15 minutes talking about the dangers of reckless driving at Georgia, but an episode dedicated solely to one Pac-12 team who, due to the media rights deals and whatnot, we can barely watch over here in this country. I think that speaks volumes about what Deion Sanders brings to the University of Colorado. He has, in a very short space of time, made this football program, without any on-field results, one of the most relevant programs in college football right now. Everyone is talking about Colorado, and we're going to talk about him for the next, you know, however many minutes, for the right reasons and for the wrong reasons. But he's brought significant media attention to the University of Colorado, the likes of which they haven't seen for a number of years. You know, this has been a successful college football program. Don't get me wrong. But it has not been a successful college football program in recent years. In fact, it's been rock bottom. And we're going to get to some of why and the what's and the whys and the wherefores and stuff. But I think first of all, he brings attention to the University of Colorado. You mentioned the words color and splash and all that and sizzle, and that's what he brings. We talked about Nil. He brings an incredible Nil value for several of the student athletes at Colorado. And Colorado is just entertaining right now for the right reasons and the wrong reasons. So I've sat and watched a few of Deion Sanders' press conferences, and whether you like the guy or you hate the guy, he's entertaining. And, you know, whole scouting evaluation to a 90-year-old woman taking the opening kickoff of the spring game was just, like, you can't make it up, which is one of the things that makes college football great. And Deion Sanders is bringing that to Colorado. And I think for me, until they set foot on the field in the early days of September, that's what he brings. Now it remains to be seen what he brings on the actual field and the reasons why we wait and see what that actually looks like, or we'll talk about over the next sort of few minutes. But yeah, attention, I think, is the big word of what Deion Sanders brings to Colorado.
I think it's a really smart move for Deion as well to go to Colorado. I actually rubbished it for him back when they hired him. But the time and hindsight are beautiful things when looking at decisions like this. And I actually think it'll end up being the best thing for him, because he goes to Colorado with no ties to that school, which somewhat lifts some of the pressure that he would be under as a still inexperienced head coach. Had he gone to Florida State, had that opportunity arisen, and had he jumped straight from Jackson State to a program like Florida State. So you go to Colorado, and similarly, and I'm not going to say that Deion Sanders is the next Nick Saban, but people forget the short spell that Nick Saban had at Michigan State, where, again, out of the spotlight, you have that chance to run a big program, but not a super program. And you get to experiment a little bit. You get to fail. You get to try, and you get to kind of find your way a little bit more at a big but not huge program. And then if the Florida States of the world, if the anywhere else in the world, if he has success at Colorado, he could go anywhere. You know, it's that kind of school. It's big enough that if you have success there, you're going to be the first in line for the top jobs in college football. But it's also small enough that they'll let you leave for those top jobs in college football. So, you know, it's also the kind of job where if they're bad early on, it will make the press. If they start okay this year and fall off towards the end of the year, he'll be fine. There'll be very little press about him, because it'll all be on whichever teams are streaking towards the playoff at that point. So, you know, lots of positives. If he has success there, then he becomes the hottest coaching ticket around. And so, you know, I think really smart move for Deion as well as for Colorado.
Certainly, not for the last time this evening, the phrase will be uttered. It's going to be an interesting one to watch. It is going to be fascinating to watch. And part of that fascination is going to be where Colorado is going to be playing its football, but we'll touch on that in a little bit. But I guess for anyone who's been following the story, even for anyone who hasn't been following the story, the headlines that have been thrown about the school is just the deconstruction and the reconstruction of the roster, right? I mean, the numbers that are coming and going have created national headlines. They've also created some criticism from the fellow head coaching community, something that you don't necessarily see that often in college football, where coaches, particularly Pat Narduzzi, has been incredibly critical of the way that Dion is going about his roster change. And I think I read something earlier that Colorado has had more than 25% of the total Pac-12 transfers this season, which is quite a startling number. But to both of you, what do you think about the reconstruction of the roster? I think we'll all agree that something needed to be done, because it was a program which was just not performing. But it's quite a dramatic start to his tenure at Colorado.
Yes, I mean, it's almost a unique situation driven by a couple of things. You know, obviously Dion's going to play the transfer portal and the transfer market most in an extreme compared to other coaches, because he doesn't have the same level of institutional experience that they do. He's not set in his ways in the same way that a lot of coaches are. But he's also super smart, and he will know the upcoming changes to transfer rules that will be coming in the next few years, where you have you'll be allowed one free transfer, I believe, in the portal. Obviously, that excludes grad transfers. It will also exclude hardship transfers like normal, but hardship transfers are going to be really, really hard to get approved in the future. So, you know, my coach left won't be a hardship transfer. I don't play isn't going to be a hardship transfer in the future. So, you know, that makeover needed to happen this year while the rules are still so loose. And then as soon as those stricter rules come in, Dion won't be able to leverage the system in the way that he has this year. So, you know, I think it was needed for Colorado, and it was needed for Dion to get it done this year so that he could have the full extent of the system that he's kind of learned to play in the best way possible right now. And, you know, there's always people that are jealous when you innovate on how you use a system that's out there, especially if you do it within the rules, which he's doing.
Ollie, a couple of questions for you. As Alex said, he's not done anything which is not within the rules. Pat Narduzzi's comment was, you know, when you come in as a coach, the guys that are on the roster are your guys, right? It's not an NFL team, it's a college football team. So you coach with what you've got, and then as other coaches have done, you build the program up from there. So one is Dion reinventing the wheel with this, and two, which is the one I'm probably more interested in from your perspective, how is the roster looking at this point? I appreciate we've not got into summer or fall camps, right? So still pretty early days, but how is it looking?
Yeah, so Pat Narduzzi is always a nicely outspoken guy. So it's always interesting to hear his opinion. He doesn't back away from it. At the end of the day, Dion, like Alex said, Dion Sanders isn't doing anything against the law, against the rules, maybe against sporting gentlemen's handshake rules, whatever you want to call it. Maybe it's kind of, well, this isn't the way it's the traditional, well, this isn't the way it's been done. Well, there's nothing to say it can't be done the way Dion Sanders is doing it. And not only that, is Dion Sanders isn't shy about doing it the way that he's doing it. Very first press conference, he said, we're coming, we're bringing the guys that we want. And that's what he's doing. That's what he's done. And he's reiterated that time and time and again. So there's no backhandedness about it. There's no hiding it under the carpet. This is what I can do. This is what we're going to do. And this is why we're going to do it. And why we're going to do it is because Colorado finished pretty much bang bottom of the college football in every single possible metric you can think of on both sides of the ball. So it had to happen if he wants to make a success of Colorado. And, you know, he's got a blank sheet to do it. And, you know, guys like Dabo Sweeney and Pat Narduzzi and those coaches that are kind of stuck in the mud, stuck in the past. These are the guys who frequently bemoan name, image, and likeness legislation, whatever you want to call it. You've got to move with the times, and because college football is moving with the times. And that's all that Deion Sanders is doing, to my mind.
It's interesting you say that, Ollie, because you know he's not bemoaning it right now. Is Nick Saban and Kirby Smart? You know, it's all the guys that are, to use the term that the kids like to use, mid. All the mid coaches in college football are bemoaning it. All the ones that are too fucking scared to try something different in order to win their conference or make it so that they have a 10-win season. Yeah, all of those guys are so stuck in their ways that they're boring. Yeah, and their programs will forever be boring. They're the ones that are outspoken about it, not because they have some greater sense of entitlement to their athletes. Yeah, it's all bollocks. It's because they're scared that someone else is trying something different and might actually be successful when they don't have the stones to try and be a bit different compared to others out there.
Well, I mean, Lane Kiffin's been pretty successful in the transfer portal. I mean, he's not been shy about going in, and in fact, over the last two seasons, Ole Miss have heavily relied upon the transfer portal. But I guess the counter to that is you look at Florida State, for example. Mike Norvell is building something pretty reasonable there, having inherited a complete mess. So I think there's a place for both, right? It's just that Dion's at the one end of the spectrum, and he's way out there at the end of the spectrum. And I think to Ollie's point, when you go that far out, people are going to try and knock you down. And just as you said, Alex, it's going to go one of two ways. It's probably going to go three ways, but you know, it's either going to be a resounding, you know, reasonable success in the first year, or it's going to be a complete disaster, and then people are, you know, the claws are going to be out. Ollie, talk to us about the recruitment and how successful that's been, because he's managed to get some high profile recruits in there, but what about the rest?
Yeah, I think so the original question was, what does the Colorado roster look like? And between recruiting and the transfer portal, I think it's substantially, to my mind, it's a substantially better roster than when we went into the 2022 college football season, without a doubt. From a recruiting perspective, you look at the cornerback, Kamoni McLean, who was committed to Miami, I think off the top of my head, originally before Deion rocked up at Colorado. He's going to be a day one starter as a true freshman. You've got guys like Dylan Edwards, the running back, who's a 100-meter runner, absolute jitterbug of a running back. He's a great, he was a great get for Colorado. So they've had a lot of success from a recruiting perspective. And then the transfers, you know, you start on the offensive side of the ball with Shedeur Sanders, obviously his son, the quarterback. That's significant. I'm trying to not use the word significant upgrade, but it is. There's no two ways about it. And obviously Travis Hunter, who made such great headlines for Jackson State when he followed Deion Sanders to Jackson State, follows him to Colorado. He's going to play both sides of the ball. You're looking at a kid. For me, I think Travis Hunter has the ability to be like a Charles Woodson type Heisman contender who can play, you know, cornerback, can play to be involved in special teams, can be involved offensively as well. Again, that's not the sort of level of player that Colorado had last year. Look at a guy like Xavier Weaver and Jimmy Horn, who they brought in wide receivers, upgraded on the offensive line, the defense, they upgraded. You can have Travis Hunter on one side and Kamoni McLean on the other side at cornerback. Yeah, he's done a great job of upgrading that roster. How does it translate to the field? This is going to be the key thing, because you've got a lot of pieces that are going to have to gel. And I lose track of the amount of times we've said on this podcast things like, you know, we were talking to Eric McLean about offensive line cohesion and getting your offensive line to gel and really maximize the strengths as one unit rather than five individuals. That's going to take some time. And, you know, the Pac-12 is going to be extremely competitive this year. Does Colorado have the best roster in the Pac-12? No, I don't think they do. For all the ins with the recruiting and transfer portal, still going to be a tough ask to get those guys playing as a cohesive unit from day one. So I don't think you're going to see Colorado make this incredible switch from worst to first. But the moves that they've made, certainly they're not going to be the whipping boys of the Pac-12 like they were last year.
Ollie, tell me, what is a jitterbug of a running back? Because I thought a jitterbug was a dance move, so I'm intrigued by this dancing running back that Colorado have recruited.
I love Dylan Edwards. To me, jitterbug is a dance move, but you watch running backs, you watch any football player, there's dance moves on grass is what's going on there. There's dance moves on grass, lateral agility, the body control, just like watching me on the dance floor.
A bit of a shimmy here, a shimmy there.
Exactly.
So with all
I didn't even talk. I was mentioning Dylan Edwards. I didn't even talk about Alton McCaskill, the running back from Houston. That is probably one of the greatest pickups they had in the transfer portal.
Biggest mistake is asking you about the roster because you'd be here all night. We're trying to keep this to under 45 minutes.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
So that said, because there's two things I want to ask, but when taking all that into account, keen to hear your views on what does success in year one look like for Deion Sanders, because we all have an idea of the kind of character that he is. He's a highly demanding competitor. He's a winner, has proven that throughout his entire life. We've all seen his kind of speeches when he arrived at his addresses to the team when he arrived at Colorado. There was no mucking about, that's for sure. Part of this will be the management of his expectations. But what do you think is a successful first year for? I'm going to ask you both. So, Ollie, what's a successful first year for Colorado?
Well, anything better than 1-11 last year is a success, right? What would Deion deem success? I think when you look at the schedule that they've got, it isn't going to be easy for Colorado. Start at TCU. TCU, by no stretch of the imagination, are going to be, I don't think, are going to be anywhere near as strong as they were last year. I don't see a national championship game team at TCU this year, but it's not going to be easy. It's not an easy road game to start the season for Colorado. Nebraska are going to be an interesting team. They've traveled to Oregon. They have to play USC. Basically, they have to play historically over the last few seasons the best teams that the Pac-12's had to offer. I mean, they avoid Washington, which is probably a bonus for them, but they have to travel to Utah, to Salt Lake City. So there's a lot of tough games on that schedule. I think if Colorado come out of 2023 college football season at 500, at 6-6, I think that is that's a solid baseline to build going forward. With that schedule, with the turnover of the roster, where they're coming from, I think to go 6-6 would be an impressive feat, in all honesty. Now, it might not be the success that people are expecting from Colorado, but I think if you're expecting them to magically be this national championship contending team in year one, that's a unrealistic expectation as far as I'm concerned.
Alex, you're a competitor, and I'm pretty certain that outwardly Deion Sanders he'll be looking for a winning season, if not a successful winning season. How does he manage his expectations? Because as you mentioned at the top of the show, he remains a very inexperienced head coach in college football. How does he manage those expectations? And then, you know, what do you think is a successful season for him?
I think if you go bowling in year one, that's a solid season for Colorado. You know, like Ollie said, 500 or just above, make it good to watch. you know, win some, lose some close games against good opponents. You don't get blown out by SC, don't get blown out by Utah, don't get blown out by Oregon, you know. I think that's the most important thing. Show that you can compete is always big in year one. And I think, you know, much of this preseason expectations guide won't really factor into Dion's thinking right now in the same way it does us, because especially in a game like football where it's so physical, you can't go in thinking you're going to lose in a game, no matter who you play. You know, you hear it in the NFL, 32 teams think they can win the Super Bowl every year. Yeah, even though us in the media and us as fans, us outside of the bubble, know that that's probably not the case, almost certainly not the case. And it's the same with college football. You know, there's probably only a handful of teams that could win a national championship. But there'll be a lot of teams that are sitting there this offseason going, well, why can't we beat TCU from last year? You know, why can't we make that run? And Colorado are probably sitting there thinking that right now. You know, Dion's thinking, how do we win game one? How do we go into that game and win? How do we might be looking ahead at game two, probably starting a little bit of game planning for game two as well, and game three, just kind of see where his team would be at and how to combat those games. In terms of looking beyond that, I doubt there's a huge amount of that right now. You know, it's going to be win. How do we win the first game? You know, and how do we be the most successful we can be over the course of the season? And the minute you start to put numbers and positions on it is where you start to look at the top of the mountain rather than the next step ahead of you. And if you do that, you lose focus on what's right in front of you, and that's where you start to slip up as you move on. So, you know, I think he will be in public. He'll say, you know, they're going to try and do the best they can do. They're going to try and win everything. In private, they'll be looking ahead to game one and winning game one and what the next step is, what the next brick in the wall is, to use a phrase of my new favorite internet sensation on YouTube, a guy called Hardest Geezer, who is currently running from the southernmost tip of Africa to the northernmost tip of Africa. Fucking nutcase. But that brick in the wall mentality is something that it goes around professional sport a lot, and I know this is college athletics, but it's, let's face it, it's professional sport at this point. So it's my take on it anyway, G.
I thought you were starting to quote Pink Floyd songs, and I was getting really concerned as to what's happened to you since you moved out to California. The Pac-12, as we have talked about before, is not the happiest place to be right this moment, and some fairly unpleasant news for the commissioner this week, the fact that ESPN are going to walk away, and that leaves the TV deal somewhat perilous, notwithstanding the fact that reports that CBS have overpaid, prepaid, whatever way you want to look at it, and are looking for money back. As far as I can understand, Pac-12 doesn't have the money to send back to them. Therefore, unsurprising rumors continue to circle that the Pac-12 is ripe for picking, and with the Big 12 looking perhaps enviously to grab some teams away, that story is just not going away. And this week, that again, Colorado might be whipped away to the Big 12. So, I guess my question is: for how much longer does Colorado continue to play in the Pac-12. I mean, clearly nothing can happen this season, but what's your thoughts on the Pac-12 remaining as it is just now?
Begins to look perilous. Bit of alliteration for you there. Perilous Pac-12. It does begin to look a little perilous for the Pac-12. And it kind of feels like we've been having this conversation for longer than just the USC and UCLA bolting for the Big Ten. More alliteration for you, bolting for the Big Ten. It does seem pretty bleak. which is a real shame, I think. I think I speak for all of us. We say we love watching the Pac-12. Nothing is more enjoyable than still being up at 7 o'clock in the morning watching a Washington State game. But it does feel like, you know, USC and UCLA might be the first of several dominoes as college football continues to realign and evolve. And, you know, the Big 12 will have, you know, spaces to fill once Texas and Oklahoma head to the SEC. Obviously, they added some new faces from the group of five who will join this year. But they're not going to turn their noses up at getting some, especially a Colorado team that, as we've mentioned at the top of the show, is now very, very relevant. They're not going to turn their noses up at adding a Colorado and some of the other, you know, the other teams knocking around potentially as a fallout from the Pac-12.
Colorado back in the Big 12 would be perfect. Get that game against Nebraska back as a regular fixture in college football, you know, have those rivalries, makes the game interesting.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, I saw again in the media, you can't get a ticket for that game for love nor money, right? Completely sold out as it is.
We give Nebraska a lot of shit on this podcast, but the fans of Nebraska for sport, I know there's not a lot else to do in Lincoln, right? It's not really a thriving cultural hub in the same way some other places in the US are. But those fans show the fuck out for games. Like they love their Nebraska teams. You know, they're just such a great fan base. And I really want them to be successful because they deserve it. You know, the sellout streak, the way they support their team, you know, it'd be good for them to have some success under Matt Rule and go forward. And Colorado fans are similar in that they maybe not quite got the same diehard reputation, but you know, they respond when they have to face Nebraska, which is why it's a game I think should be on the docket every year, similar to, you know, Michigan, Ohio State, Oklahoma, Texas. You know, these games need to happen every year.
It's not a game that necessarily jumps out, but I remember a few years ago speaking to Nate Landman at Colorado, and asked him what was the game that he most enjoyed during his time playing at Colorado, and without a blink of an eye, it was the Nebraska game, and I hadn't quite appreciated how much of a rivalry that game is. It is massive. Well, you know, so the chances of Colorado remaining in the Pac-12, or in fact the Pac-12 remaining as the Pack, whatever it's going to be, are looking slimmer and slimmer. So on that very negative note, we'll leave it as everybody rolls about laughing. That's all from us on this episode. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe, rate and review, and we'll be your friends for life. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Our Twitter account is @collegechat, so please give us a follow. Thanks again to Ollie and Alex for their brilliant input. I'm kind of canvassing that maybe we keep Alex in California as our on-the-ground resident.
I don't think he'd mind
podcaster.
That.
I don't think he'd mind that at all, to be honest. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and well, and catch you all next time.